Good afternoon. I'm happy to be back. If you know my story, I have had some rather trying times of getting here to be with you. The first time I came for the forum on how to repurpose, reuse Fort Ord, I was on my way to the hotel. I was stopped by the policeman. Because I had stopped for directions and I didn't turn my lights back on. And then I was also caught with talking on my cell phone. So I didn't realize all the rules here. It was a very nice interaction, however. I had a very nice conversation about what should I tell you all, the business leaders, about what to do about the reuse of Fort Ord. So I conveyed that in my messages. This time, I was caught in the snowstorm in Washington, D.C. Turns out I was one of only two planes that got out all day yesterday from the snowstorm. So I'm happy to be here. And you can tell it took a lot of determination on my part, certainly this time, to be here. And I really wanted to return and share some of my knowledge and experience about how do you leverage your universities in regional economic development. My presentation, I'm going to do it in three parts. One, I would like to set the context, sort of understanding what the challenges are for universities and for communities and states, and what we have to do to think about as the backdrop, the big picture, when we're thinking about what we ask our universities to do or how we work with our universities. Then the second part, I'll talk about some of the frameworks. How do we decide the right framework that all of us can use, both the business community, the university, policymakers, on helping leverage the strengths at the universities, but also build the strengths of the universities so that they help your community prosper and grow and compete in a global economy. And then the third part of my presentation, which I think is probably the more fun, so I will speed through the rest of it and try to get to those, is really to bring you some examples that show some of the how things have been put into practice elsewhere, and who might also give you some ideas. Not all of them will be totally matching up with your community or with your university, but I think what my experience is, you take from the best and you bring them home and you use them for how they work for you. You meld those ideas into how they work for you, for your community, and for your university. So let me start with the key public policy themes. As was mentioned, I work for the National Governors Association. It's an association of all the nation's governors. Governor Brown is part of our NGA and very active. But what I've seen over the last 5 years or so in terms of what's changed in the public policy debate and perspective of governors, and I say state, but I'm telling you that cities, and I think counties, those of you who are leaders from the city, the cities and the counties here will also, these ideas, these themes will resonate with you and what you've been thinking about. First and foremost is that everybody's been concerned about the budget revenue. Where do we get the dollars? When are we going to come back to the state that we were before 2007? And then now we're starting to see surpluses emerge, and what do we do with those surpluses? How do we invest those surpluses? So it's a really great time to be having these kinds of conversations. The other big issue is, of course, the Medicaid and healthcare costs, government redesign and performance, and I'm going to go through these very quickly so that you get a flavor of what we're all balancing when we're thinking about our investment policy choices and investment decisions. So on the budget issue, it's really about not only not worrying about where you're going to get your revenue and how you invest, But it's really also, it's particularly related to universities, is the issue of health care. Governors are very concerned, and as are all policymakers and business leaders, very concerned about the fact that with health care eating up so much of the budget, we have very little revenue to invest in education, both in terms of the research as well as the talent that we need. And so that's a very important consideration. On government design and performance, I've been in public policy area for a long time, both at the local level and the state level, and I can tell you that this is the era of redesign and performance, holding government accountable for outcomes and seeing results. And this is an example, no offense to the academic community, but Secretary Duncan is famous for having made this quote about the biggest challenges facing our higher education today is high prices, low completion rates, and too little accountability. So I think that the bright spotlight has turned on a lot of organizations, a lot of agencies, both at the state level and the city level, of really thinking about what do we get for our investment. This is just an example of the metrics that the governor's NGA has recommended to universities and the governors to think about and how you start measuring success. And the president mentioned many of these in his opening remark. We're going to start looking at degrees awarded, graduation rates. It's not enough just to make sure students get into the universities and community colleges, but start thinking about the completion. And the jobs that they get as a result of those degrees. The other really big issue that we all feel is that even though we're seeing an end to the recession, we're not getting back as many jobs as we had and that we lost during the recession. This is a new Kaufman graph showing this is for technology firms, but as we know, technology for firms lead a lot of the job creation and creation. And you can see that we're just not catching up. From the creation part of jobs is not above the job destruction. So it's really this issue, a very big challenge of thinking about what's going on with, has the economy turned soft on risk and entrepreneurship? The company's just adding jobs more slowly. And that's certainly a concern for almost every policymaker and certainly many of the business communities as well. Then we think a lot about the issues of unemployed Americans. And this is my favorite quote. While all of us were worried about the pensions at the local level and our retirees at the state level, it was sort of Paul Krugman who really said, we ought to start thinking about the unemployed Americans, not the folks who have retirements and pensions, but what do we do about the unemployed Americans? And importantly, in the national capital in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere, for the first time ever, I've seen more articles written about what's the issue about social mobility? What are we going to do about social mobility? And more people are having that conversation, which I think is all very positive. Well, the real issue is, because of all of these issues, what I see in states and local communities all across the country is it's really become a call for an all-hands-on-deck. People are really worried about the economy, and it's really thinking about it's just not about the Economic Development Agency anymore. It's in the state level. It's not just about the Department of Commerce. But it's about the universities thinking about economic development. It's about the energy office thinking about economic development. How is clean energy going to be part of the economic development solution? It's about healthcare thinking about part of the economic development equation, not only in terms of jobs and the training, the talent that's needed, but thinking about reducing the healthcare costs. So just this notion of everybody's got to be on board when we're thinking about what are we going to do about regional economic growth. And what I find very interesting, and when you look at this list here, one of the things that governors are starting to recognize, and I think local communities are recognizing, is that if you look at all those bullet points, one of the most important things you find out is the universities play a role in almost every one of those bullet points. And in the past, governors and many mayors might have thought it was all about the Economic Development or the Commerce Agency, but really starting to recognize that what matters in terms of talent and even revitalization of communities, that really is not something that traditionally falls within our thinking about what's the responsibility of economic development organizations. So it is a time of all hands on deck or all in, as some have said. And then we turn to 2014. And I can tell you now, all of those of us who look through the State of the State messages around the country by all the governors, here's the theme. It is definitely a really laser focus on education, workforce, and economic development. The notion that we've got to have better alignment between what is going on in our economies, what is the education pipeline to match that economy and also the workforce, and what does it take to do that. I'm going to show you a couple of slides. This is a brochure of the National Governor's Initiative that's going on in this area. But you can see why we're worried about this. Why is the issue that's front and center right now? And this is a slide from Harvard University, Harvard Business School, Michael Porter and many others at Harvard Business School, including all the major CEOs, have taken on the issue of America's competitiveness, made it a major effort of all of Harvard, just as MIT has taken on the issue of advanced manufacturing, thinking about really strategically what's it going to take to help America compete, both in terms of research, but particularly in terms of talent, and particularly in terms of how do we help small and medium-sized businesses survive and thrive in a global economy. But I love this chart where you're really looking at where are the strengths that are disappearing, and you can see the skilled labor as one of the really key issues that everybody's focused on. Another disturbing trend is really, this is very well put, I think, back to the notion of we have 7% of the folks unemployed, but companies consistently report that they cannot find employees they need to fill jobs. Yet, as McKinsey and others have pointed out in surveys, a third of employers never communicate with education institutions about their needs. And third, and the third bullet, a third of education institutions can't estimate their job placement rates. Those that can often overestimate it. So it sort of puts on the table some of the trends and some of the reasons why we're focused on more and more of what are the contributions of universities to our economies. Four more considerations just to put out there as the background. We're finding as states and local communities and universities, we're dealing with more and more players. In the you know, last decade, maybe we worried about what the state was doing next door, what the university was doing down the street, what the city was doing in the next region. But now we're really thinking about, as you well know, China, India, Singapore, Eastern Europe, really just much more, have to know much more about what's going on all across the world. The other thing is the changing fiscal dynamics. While we're all thinking about how do we get out of this economy, how do we start to invest in the things that really matter, you look at what the investments being made around the country, and it makes all of us nervous. My favorite one is a new research university with a day one endowment of $10 billion, equal to what it took MIT 142 years to accumulate. Creating entire a global nanotechnology hub, including constructing 14 new world-class universities. That's enough to make us all wonder what the heck we do to compete going forward. A rising demand on professionalism. Multinational corporations have been locating all over the world, and they come back telling us that the professional knowledge and understanding of their industry around the world is different than what they're finding in the United States. And so this raises the bar for the economic professional community and the universities and elected officials to understand what the economy is, what industry needs. And then finally, the whole notion that we have to start managing an innovation ecosystem, which I'm going to talk a lot more about. But it's really interesting because when you learn what it means by to manage an innovation ecosystem, we find out that it's probably not what any of our agencies do. So certainly not economic development organizations, maybe pieces of a university, maybe some associations, but it's really starting to think about what the heck does that mean when I'm managing an innovation ecosystem. So those are kind of negative thoughts. So before I turn to the rest of my presentation, I thought I should raise your spirits a little bit with some positive signs. So let's talk about five positive signs. More diplomas. I love this. This is from somebody else. I've cited the source here. We're seeing more diplomas. High school graduation rates have risen. This says 78% in 2010, but if anybody watched the All-Star game, which I didn't, but I read about it in the newspaper, Secretary of Education Duncan played, and his jersey was 80. Does anybody know what that was for? It's exactly. The graduation rate was up to 80%. So that's good news. There's new knowledge with less cost. That's good news. Lower healthcare inflation, and then powering America with less. So there are some very positive signs on the horizon, and then I'll share a few more. And that the National Governors Association just had its winter meeting in Washington, D.C. in February, and our keynote speaker was Jeff Immelt, CEO of GE. And here's what he told the nation's governors. So you're going to see me sprinkle a lot of his comments throughout my presentation, because it just really puts a he was so articulate and he was so good at expressing industry's perspective, what he needs from public, what they need from public policy, what they need from institutions. And so I thought I couldn't say them better. So you're going to see a little bit of his comments sprinkled out through my presentation. So here is the positive news. Bottom line is we're seeing growth, but it's very slow, and it's going to be volatile and slow for a long time. And if he was warning us that if we locate a facility in your state or your community, it's not to serve your state, it's to serve the larger global world. He and other corporations are looking for locations that help him to be competitive globally. And then the good news is he's been all over, and he finds that the U.S. workers are up to the task for producing the goods that are competitive in the global marketplace. The other three things that I found interesting was, where is GE investing, and where are its three big themes? And I think this helps us think about, where are we looking at the future? Where are we looking at the opportunities? One is obviously living in an age of natural gas. The whole idea that the game's changed with the idea of cheaper power, but also all the new technologies that come with that, and who's taking advantage of those opportunities. Advanced manufacturing, I think you all know, you read the headlines, everybody's worrying about, thinking about the opportunities in advanced manufacturing and how it benefits the U.S. and our communities. And GE made a very powerful statement about the five kinds of investments he will be making in the U.S., and we'll talk about some of those as we go along, because they're very relevant to the kinds of things that I think all communities should stay focused on, and certainly with their relationships to their universities. And then finally, the whole idea of the growth of the industrial internet. Basically, that the application of sensors and data analytics and communications will be an important part of the manufacturing process, production process, and his prediction is that it will be as important in terms of what the amount of people it involves in innovation as the social internet has been in the past. So I think those are all very positive statements, and I think that's at least something to look forward to. But I also would like to bring back to the point where I think what we're seeing over and over again from governors and from the business leadership, that universities have always been important, but they're going to be more important than ever before. And those communities that have universities are certainly ahead of the game. Those communities who don't need to figure out how to connect to universities elsewhere, and I will give you examples on how to do that. And frankly, I would say this, and I hope the president's not offended, but my view is all communities, you connect to as many universities as you can, but in an organized way, and hopefully through the window of the university that you have here. And I'll talk about some of those examples. So the message to me is, or to you, and to me, and everybody should be, what I'm finding is policymakers are doubling down on policy and the expectations for universities. And I characterize this policy in two ways. There's been the Policy Agenda 101, which was largely about, for the past years, thinking about getting more Americans into and successfully out of college. So for a long time, it was the discussion was a lot about access, a very important discussion, and it's still very important, as we know, because of the issues about financial aid and other issues. But it's also turned towards getting students successfully out of college. So that's one track. The other track is, and many universities don't like this track, frankly, and that's sort of doubling down on the policy and the expectations that the universities will be active and help create new good-paying jobs in the economy and making workers ready for those jobs. So now we're talking about not just an education role, but also a workforce development role. And traditionally, that's not been something that many universities have seen as maybe something they were engaged in. But the important thing is to show how it's evolved. So, and the president mentioned this as we started out, so I thought we're right on sync here. I think the question is no longer how many degrees you're producing, but degrees for what jobs? The discussion has changed about, and the accountability's changed towards what jobs, degrees for what jobs. And it's been really evident to me when I go out and have a discussion in communities. We actually have had a project working with universities and communities and governors to think about setting state goals. The goals the way the president has set the goals in terms of we want to see X percent of our population with a bachelor's degree or an associate's degree plus a bachelor's degree. But when I go out and I'm part of those discussions, and when they brought the academic institutions and the business community together, it without fail, the business community says, no, don't set a state goal of how many more degrees. Tell me how many degrees you're going to have in healthcare, in IT, in my industry. It's not about the generic degrees. It's about the generic number of degrees or percentage, but start to drill down even more and talk about how degrees for what jobs and what positions. And Jeff Immelt really put the nail on the head. I've summarized all of sort of his statements to GE looks for in a state. I use state because that's what he's talking about, but he was talking about communities. So please read into state, region, local. You can see the other things. I'm going to focus on the blue bullets. But I think all of them are very important to how you think about working with industry. But my favorite one was the talented workforce. It's a good thing when a governor or a mayor can describe how many welders and engineers they prepare every year. He made it really clear that one of the reasons he's put facilities in Vietnam is that one of the first conversations he had was basically they could tell me how many welders and engineers they could promise that they would have. And it's been an incredible partnership. And so that's kind of the standards in terms of where he's looking forward. But I thought that was a very good statement about tell me how many welders and how many engineers you're going to prepare. Other industries will want the same kind of message. Showing you how the conversation has evolved is this slide again from the Harvard Business School. So how many people ever thought that the Harvard Business School would be working with the business community to really parse exactly degrees for what jobs? What careers are going to have the most lifetime value, you can see on the bottom axis, and what are going to be the most valuable to the business? And as you know from the quadrants, the green one is the most sought-after quadrant in terms of high value to business and high value to the individual. This is getting very, everybody's raising the bar in the game in terms of how you start thinking about the talent and how we interact with the universities and the community colleges to communicate the talent that's going to be important to business. And then how do we communicate with our students and our children to think about where is the degree that's going to give you the most career lifetime value. Here's another one that I like. I pulled out just because it shows the career pathway. Really charting out. And again, let me tell you that the business community, the CEOs have commissioned the Harvard Business School to start looking at these kinds of analysis and also surveying the business community to talk about how they're engaged with the universities and the community colleges and communicating their needs and interacting and solving the needs, which we'll talk a little bit. So the other doubling down on the policy is creating jobs. So in the past, we worried about our universities having a better tech transfer office and worrying about how we get those last licenses, academic licenses out the door and with and commercialized and created a new business. And I'm talking too long on this part, so I'm not going to go into the details. But the point I want to make is doubling down on the policy in this area and the expectations of the universities. It started, the conversation was about, well, how many jobs are you creating? How many entrepreneurs are you helping us nurture? To really moving much more to a conversation about recognizing that how do you help us create an innovation hub? And this is a picture of MIT Boston, certainly a very stellar, not everybody's going to be able to be that particular innovation hub. But what we've learned from studying these kinds of innovation hubs is that there is something important about locations that really allows for, that foster co-location of anchor institutions like meds and eds, as we call them, with the businesses and then the surrounding community around them that allows for the easy interactions, the networks, everything that's out there. And right smack in the middle of many of these innovation hubs are universities. And academic institutions, and really starting to think about, okay, how does the university help me do that? We want them to still commercialize their research, but really, what is it, and what is the strategy that helps us as a community create these kinds of innovation hubs that both attract new companies, but also, more importantly, grow our own entrepreneurs? So what will be key when we're looking at this? We're looking at innovation hubs through an ecosystem, a habitat lens, and assembling a multidisciplinary leadership team that partners with the community to ensure that the region is being ambitious enough and comprehensive enough. If we haven't gone around and visited all the innovation hubs, it's really hard to know if we're ambitious enough. And it's really important to bring that kind of perspective to your community because a lot of places are very much focused on this. And it starts with reimagining the spaces around your universities and your medical research institutions as places that can be shaped physically and strategically to anchor an innovation ecosystem. In earlier conversations, it was pointed out that you have something like 30 or so research institutions or anchor institutions in addition to the university to be thinking about that. And then how do you get all those critical ingredients together? That's about smart people, research institution, entrepreneurial training, and mentors, professional networks, all as well as the placemaking attributes that allow for interaction but also quality of life and ensures that people want to be here. So those are actually what we mean in terms of doubling down on the expectations of universities, what communities are starting to have of their universities, and what universities ought to start thinking about how do they contribute to the local economy. So let me tell you a little bit about how do you think about all this. That's a lot of factors. I've been through a lot of things thinking about, well, what are all those factors that go in an ecosystem? What are all the factors that we think about? And frankly, we have to have all this. We need to have the same framework, or at least a fairly similar framework, because we can't invest together. We can't co-lead together. We can't coordinate to move the business community, the economic development organizations, and the universities all together if we don't have some kind of strategic framework to think about those policy decisions and the investments to be made. So I'm going to put out two that I think are valuable, and then I will move to some examples. I think anybody in my shoes would tell you that you have to focus on what drives growth. This is the classic statement in terms of thinking about productivity, as Michael Porter told the governors in 2011. You can focus on whatever you want, but productivity determines wages, productivity sets jobs, productivity determines the standard of living. The productivity of your industries and your workers are what's really, in those companies, are really what's going to help drive your economy. And I don't know an organization yet that says that's their mission statement. However, I did find one in Alaska recently called the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute that was created in 1981 to help the seafood industry not only manage its resources, but to add value. And so it's increases productivity, frankly. Its words were their mission is to increase the volume and the value of the seafood industry. And I was just in at a session there, and I was telling some of the colleagues here earlier that I heard somebody who spearheads a similar kind of effort in Iceland talk at this conference about how you squeeze value out of a cod. And he proceeded to put a diagram of a cod fish up on the screen and show little by little all the waste that in the past had been just thrown out, and how when you started getting all the industry together with the universities and with other industry, across industries like the pharmaceutical industry, the medical industry together, what you could squeeze out of value out of a cod. And you ended up with what they used to think was the most valuable piece of cod was not what was the most valuable piece of cod. What was the most valuable piece of cod was about this much oil that goes something like $240 for cosmetics. And they never dreamed of this. And now they're thinking about how to use cod to make clothes and material and whatever. But that is a definition of increasing productivity if I've ever seen it. So I love it. Many of the speakers, though, we had nightmares for 2 days for the rest of the time dreaming about that cod and how you dissect it. So if you're focusing on productivity, that's kind of a technical term. Businesses talk about it. I'm not really suggesting that maybe that's the right mission statement, but I think the point is, so I think we all have to be better students of knowing where growth comes from. And I've in the right after the recession, we had the CHAIRS initiative was about growing state economies, and my first job was to go through the literature. I have a bipartisan group. It's a nonpartisan organization. It's R's and D's. So my first job was to say, let's say what the literature says matters for growth, and let's all start on a common page of understanding what we're focusing on. And so this is from the literature, but what the most important thing is, of course, you got to focus on entrepreneurs, those individuals who seed and grow companies and renew companies. You got to focus on education skills. Over and over again, it's been proving that a concentration of skills and educated individuals in a community are one of the most important things for driving growth and certainly productivity. Now, Kaufman has a new study that basically is pointing out that actually the best indicator of innovation and entrepreneurship are not the patents and things that come out of universities, but the critical mass of highly educated talent. It's talking about innovation and technology, private capital, global markets and linkages and industry clusters, understanding that firms that are in an industry cluster are stronger in terms of their productivity and their ability to compete. And certainly strong clusters produce more job creation, more entrepreneurs, and usually high value or high wage jobs. So thinking about really focusing on those things. The other most important thing about this, in addition to understanding that, is really thinking about, you know, the role of the university in every one of those areas. Even in private capital, frankly, not private capital, but more and more the universities are actually saying, we can't just wait around anymore. We have access to a lot of very wealthy individuals who sit on our foundations and other places and alumni, and really starting to accumulate angel capital and capital to help with even the capital issue. The other important thing to point out is the global markets. I often tell a governor and other leaders that who do you think is one of the most globally connected entities in your community or your state? They'll always name the largest company, never fails. And I will say, actually, it's probably your university. Not only for the students, but probably many of their programs are related to other programs elsewhere. And if a lot of universities now are really competing very strongly to be located around the globe and thinking about that, and also training CEOs and other kinds of individuals for jobs. So there's so much there in terms of thinking about how does the university contribute in all those areas. The other important thing to think about is we think about clusters not only, and I know you've done your analysis here and know what your clusters are in many respects, but we've figured out that the most important thing about the cluster analysis is that we really have a service delivery tool. We have a way to build specialized talent pools for that industry, build unique research centers for that industry, coordinate strong collaborations and other linkages and resources that benefit a group of companies, not just one company. States have learned to do this. We're not very good on the service delivery part yet, or communities either. We're still working on that. And I'm going to show you some examples, but most importantly here too is states are also learning that joint action to enhance the impact of clusters doesn't happen automatically. It's a lot of effort to coordinate a lot of actors. They must communicate their respective needs to each other, prioritize collectively their actions. They commit resources to solve those needs and work together to streamline the delivery of resources. That doesn't happen automatically. I know we hear the stories about Silicon Valley and a lot of spontaneity. That does happen. There's no question about it. But really, when you're really starting to think about how do we show the critical mass, how do we provide linkages, it really does take some entity to start thinking about how do we coordinate some of these activities and how do we make all the connections that are going to be important. So my next part The framework I really suggest that you think about, and I advise most folks to think about in terms of where they make their policy decisions, both at a university, but a state and a local level, because I learned it from the business community. So everybody wants to know how to create an innovation hub, how to have more innovation, new ideas. So my source was I studied the Harvard Business Review, because every policy leader kept asking me, well, so what do I do, Mary Jo? What do I do? I don't get this. What do I do? Isn't this natural? What happens? So I started reading Harvard Business Review, and I can tell you that there's story after story about CEOs thinking about what does it mean to be to create an innovative environment. And there are four things that is pretty much thought about these days. Number one is you got to have expertise. You got to have smart people. You got to have smart people with ideas, for sure. You've got to have interaction. As we say, you have to figure out how to get those ideas out and out the door. And so you got to have interaction. And we learned that most of the innovation that occurs is a people-to-people kind of interaction still. So how do you think about creating that interaction, the collaboration, the networks? The third thing, it's not just about interaction, though. It's interaction among a diverse set of actors and players. So the classic example, if you're talking to people who look just like you, the same age as you, same background, same discipline, same industry, you're probably not going to see sparks fly. So the whole idea of how do we start to interact with others so that we get new ideas and other experts. And then finally, we know ideas are no good if they just sit there. So it's about the application. How do you use that idea? How do you apply it? And better yet, how do you create a business with it? So innovation's in the center. That's the sweet spot. I was just told when I was in Alaska that, did you know those four circles spell idea? So what do I know? So when you put that together, that spells idea. So I thought that was pretty clever. So let me tell you very quickly, and then I'm going to get to examples, and I'm a little bit over my time here. So let me tell you very quickly some examples. So how do you think about, both as a community and as a university, about these four circles? What kind of things, and I'm going to go through very fast, and there's a lot of examples in here, but the slides will be available. So what does it mean to build expertise? What do we think about? Build expertise. One of the best ways to build expertise is you have unique institutions that attract and support the people with the talent and the foresight to create new ideas. You got one here. You got 30 others, I've been told. Very impressive. So how do you think about those unique institutions? And by the way, even though my examples look like they're in the engineering science area, there is a clean energy one there. But it's also art institutions. Don't limit it to the normal science and technology institutes. What do you have that's unique? That signals you've got an expertise. Certainly the research strengths, thinking about your research strengths, and that's part of your statement about your expertise. More and more, a lot of places are putting research dollars into research talent, really trying to figure out the faculty and the researchers that are going to be very important to drive the conversation and signal that you have expertise in particular areas. There's research now that says that investment in this kind of talent really pays off. In fact, it's Enrico Moretti at the University of California at Berkeley has a very nice study showing that while we worry about talent being footloose, the payoffs of spending dollars on top-notch talent at your universities and your research institutions certainly pays off. Building expertise, we've already talked about a lot of these. Building your workers and your skills. New fields and young talent, focusing on new fields. More and more, when you have enter a conversation with an industry, a company or an industry, largely a cluster, you're finding out that the degrees you have, the fields you have, the colleges you have don't quite fit with what the world, how they're operating today. So thinking about those new kinds of programs, and I will tell you, make this joke that I, as you heard, I went to ASU. I'm still on the ASU email, and I get an email every day from ASU from Michael Crow. It's not really the president, but it's their email serve. And it's always, probably once a month, I hear about a new field, a new degree that's been created because of interactions with industry. Big, strong push on entrepreneurial immigrants. I love this. I don't know if it's going to work. But that Detroit and the governor of Michigan thought that this was a good strategy for bringing in talent sounded like a good idea to me. There are all kinds of hurdles there, but it shows you how creative people are being. Facilitating interactions. So I'm going to talk more about these in my examples, so I'm not going to go over them here. But so the whole idea of facilitating interaction collaboration, the notion of building innovation hubs, innovation districts. We've got classic examples from Atlanta's Technology Square, San Diego's Torrey Pines, Ohio's building theirs. We've got lots of examples. The question is you just study them and you execute them and you get the right players around the table. The mega partnerships. I'm going to talk about the institutes of collaboration. Networks are so important, part of creating the networks. Shared facilities, the idea, and I heard today, the idea of putting, you know, the college program and the technology folks together. The idea of shared facilities for researchers and businesses certainly starting to take hold all around the country. The idea of balancing the small wonders that are very important to a community so that you have that authentic places where you can go collaborate, where you want to meet and where you want to interact. And that's so important a part of this. We get caught up in the big bricks and mortar investments, and we forget about the little spaces that are very important for interaction. The idea of putting diverse knowledge fields and cultures together, again, putting different kinds of researchers, different industries in facilities together. Certainly thinking about how do you get the right brain and the left brain together. More and more we're seeing, this is one of the new degree programs at ASU, where we're putting designers and engineers together so that they get a joint degree in certain parts of it. The idea of entrepreneurship across the entire university or college, thinking about that, why not be teaching or having art students involved in entrepreneurship? All thinking about that much more strategically. Pushing commercialization. I think I've made this point, but the important thing is, and I know you're doing this here, the whole idea of having your partnerships with industry so that they're talking about what's relevant, what's going to solve their problems, what's going to be valuable in the marketplace, rather than just thinking about what I as a researcher wants to work on or a faculty member. But in the new models of entrepreneurship training, I think the important message is that we have learned so much when thinking through before this recession, but during the recession, of what really works. And picking up an old model is just not something anybody should be doing these days. And you in particular, and I know you're looking at these, the new models for entrepreneurship training are really out there and starting to show success. And, of course, they've been pioneered in Stanford, and you have right access to a lot of that talent in the back in your back door here. So I'm going to move quickly to this issue of, so you've got all these elements. You got to worry about expertise. You got to worry about talent. You got to worry about research expertise. You got to worry about talent. You got to worry about interaction. You got to worry about entrepreneurship. You got to worry about all these things. And you got all these players that make this ecosystem work. The real question that's come up now is, who coordinates all this? I don't know. If you had all these players out there, or each one's doing their own thing, you're not going to have a, much of an impact compared to what you could have if you were coordinating all of these elements. A lot of places are starting to come up with the idea of an intermediary. Maybe we need an organization that helps nurture this ecosystem, and I'm going to give you some examples of that. It could be an existing organization. Maybe it's part of the university. Maybe it's something else. There are lots of experiments bubbling up, which I'm going to talk to you a little bit about around the country. And I have to tell you, here's what I find across, we're actually studying these, here's what I find that's happening with some common characteristics. They're led by leaders who proactively find and nurture connections across the boundaries. And they know who to connect with whom. It's constantly connecting. Their speed and flexibility in working with industry, both for talent, for research, for anything, really thinking about how do you respond quickly. There's an industry focus that allows innovation to be strategically targeted at sectors that are promising to the state or region. And then there's spaces that crosses traditional academic boundaries. So what are the kind of spaces you either build on campus at Fort Ord with the reuse, or downtown? What are the spaces you build where you cross the traditional academic boundaries so that different disciplines, different people get together and interact and then push research and entrepreneurs and industries beyond their specializations and think about new discoveries and new boundaries. So those are kind of the experiments we're seeing. And let me give you some examples very quickly about what I'm seeing emerge. And I think from what I've heard in my earlier conversations, they won't totally fit with your industry clusters, but they will fit with, if you'll see, I'll point out the common themes that I see. So first and foremost is what we call, I call it ONAMI. It's the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnology Institute. So how did this get started? The state of Oregon decided they wanted to create some new emerging clusters, to find some new emerging clusters. The industry, Hewlett-Packard, Intel, all got together and said, we've got this space of small technology that nobody's playing in. But we don't have the expertise to do it. We're not world class. But if we put all four of the universities together and we add the federal lab in, plus all the industry that's primarily in the Portland area, the region, but statewide, we've got a Silicon Forest, a high-tech industry cluster, about 250 researchers in 5 institutions. So that's building the expertise across institutions, reaching out, building partnerships. And then this organization was formed with the help of state money, local money, and certainly private dollars, university dollars. We'll talk about some of that. But then it invests, this whole organization is about, first of all, finding the research expertise, figuring out how to collaborate so that we have a signature research effort, and then investing in programs in all the areas that we talked about, networking, entrepreneurs, investing in shared facilities. In the small technology space, the tools, the telescopes, everything that's required is incredibly expensive, and no small and medium-sized business really can afford a lot of them themselves. So investing in that technology so that the industry has, the small companies have access to it. And then they have created a high-tech extension service where 200 companies of all sizes on a fee-for-service basis. And this is coordinated by one individual. His name is Skip Rung. He came from Hewlett-Packard, and you need to meet Skip Rung. And all the people I'm going to talk to you about today have very similar characteristics. It's all about, and then let me be really clear, this organization does no research. It was not created to do research. It was created to find the expertise across all of the universities in Oregon, think region here, make it visible, make it known. When somebody needs to figure out how to get it, you go see Skip Rung, and now he's got others. And then thinking about that, and how do we build an expertise, how do we signal to the world that we are here to help companies, both large and small companies, compete both in innovation and commercialize those new innovation and create companies. Skip spends a lot of his time on figuring out gap financing. He spends a lot of his time on helping his companies go through entrepreneurial boot camps, and I mean the researchers go through entrepreneurial boot camps. He has all the same things you have, but it's all coordinated in a very strategic way with all the industry designing what those programs look like. So this looks a little bit like what I would say GE told what the states they could do. So you won't read this into it, but I'm going to tell you what he says here. What I read into his comments is more and more industry, large and small, are looking for tailored research, tailored talent, and a supply chain. Help with the supply chain. Help us be competitive as a supply chain. So working with all the suppliers in a collaborative way. And you get this from, so the statement here about you're looking for the community college that has a that is a plan for partnering with the industry to get workers. They're looking for universities that signal their strengths by indicating where the investments are and by collaborating across multiple institutions so that a CEO, a small and medium-sized business, knows where your strengths are, what expertise you have. And then finally, promoting, that's the supply chain, promote the big company and small, medium, and size connection for training and supply chain development. Jeff emailed, basically said, big companies don't really need the help. We need the help with the research. I'm not telling you that. But it's really help us with the small and medium-sized companies that are part of our supply chain. Help us help them improve their innovation capacity, their quality capacity, and their global capacity, and their talent that they need, because they don't really have time to be thinking about that strategically. Next example. And I'm way over. So this one I point out because this is the Virginia Advanced Manufacturing Innovation Zone. The reason I point this out is because this is one of the models that the federal administration has, President Obama's and others have been looking at as the model for it's called the National Network of Manufacturing Institutes. They're putting out awards, they're putting out grant opportunities right now. They've awarded four. They're looking for more. They have a goal of 45 of these around the country. I don't think Congress will give them that kind of money, but it's really clear the whole administration has put together all the money across DOE, U.S. Department of Commerce, Defense, to figure out how to make these institutes do exactly what we're going to talk about here, where you're focused on an industry cluster, an industry sometimes across industry, which we'll point out, and it's all about tailoring research with them helping shape the agenda, with them shaping the agenda, tailoring the talent they need, the whole talent pipeline, and working, bringing the small and medium-sized business to the table to help benefit from that interaction and that partnership. So that's what it looks like physically. But here's the big issue about how do you get money. So Center for Advanced Manufacturing, here's his purpose. You can see on the side, foster collaboration among diverse industry sectors. What's really important here is basically Rolls-Royce came to Virginia, said, you want me? This is what I need. I need tailored research, and I want all of your universities. I don't want one. I want this. I need a whole partnership, and I need other companies to be part of that partnership, and we're willing to put money on the table. So they have these companies. Not all of them are in the same industry, but they have common themes on research, common interest on research and talent. The big companies put $400,000 on the table every year. The CEOs are at the table. They design the research. Some of the research is generic for everybody. Some of it can be intellectual property goes to the company. And then they're working on the talent pipeline. Now you can see the universities. All three universities have to be there. They commit resources. The faculty's on site. And students are on site working with the industry. And the important thing is companies have to bring in a new partner every year. And now they're adding the second tier supply chain because they want the supply chain in the loop, and the supply chain, small and medium-sized companies, don't have to pay the same kind of fee. It is the model that we show all states, all communities. I know Greater Phoenix is looking at this right now. Tucson's looking at this right now. But it doesn't just have to be about this industry. You saw it with nanotechnology, and you're going to see it with wine. So here's an example of for Walla Walla. So if you know, you can see Washington had a program of 15 innovation zones, decided like all of us, we want to create innovation zones. So every place was to come up with a strategy, compete for dollars, and at the base of that was a research organization, something thinking about the innovation, the research expertise. Walla Walla, they went in for wine and hospitality, water management, and alternative energy. They started with wine and hospitality. They were so successful, I'm going to show you. They've moved into water management and alternative energy. This is led by a community college. So here's national stories, and 60 Minutes did a story on this. We bring Steve Van Huzen, who's the president of community college, often to our meetings, introduce him to governors. So here's what they decided. So Walla Walla, small community, a terrible problem of out-migration, couldn't get any of the young people to stay, losing population, decided that they could figure out, they applied to be one of the innovation zones, they got a strategy together, and they decided to take the agriculture strengths and turn it into wine. You know that story here, at least in California, but you certainly know this also with your agriculture. I think I've told you that I said earlier in a meeting, I always use the prepackaged salad mix from Salinas Valley, California, is my example of what innovation's all about. You take the existing ingredients, combine it in a new way, add a little technology, and you add value. And I pay a high price for that packaged salad mix. So here they decided to add value like the cod. Remember the cod story? So they're going to add value. It's a high-value industry. We're going to focus on high-value industry. And very important, last bullet, tourism from the wine industry is a lot more lucrative than normal tourism. So did their homework, figured out where the high value added was, ended up with not only wine, but so the community colleges, I'll show you the examples, not only the wine, but you have wine, food, and art, making it a very good package across and complementary industries. Here's their vision. I'm so totally out of time, so I can't go through all this. But you can see a very important strategy in all the partners who had to be around the table. And so here's what we have. Building expertise. Center of Innovation for the Wine Industry. This is a community college, remember? Learning for the students. Learning how to make wine as well as going to classes. So hands-on learning opportunity. So moved forward, now we've decided we can be the laboratories for all of the wine industry globally. Shared facilities, back again, remember? So we got expertise, we got talent, we got shared facilities. And now we're into wine incubators. These are the little incubators for the students to start their wineries. So we got entrepreneurship incubators. And then, whoa, we got wine export draws buyers from around the world to Walla Walla. We got global. We've got all the components. If you think back to the framework about what are the six factors that matter for growth, they got them all. They worked on all of them. They got entrepreneurs. They got innovation. They've got talent. They've got capital. They've got clusters. and they're worrying about the global interaction. I think that's a pretty amazing story. And the proof is in the pudding, so to speak. So they've pretty much calculated not only their cluster, but what the population would look like with employment growth, would look like without the wine cluster and with the wine cluster. So successful. They got another one. Now they're working on the Center for Innovation for Water and the Environment. They're working on the Southeast, the energy cluster. And so you can see success breeds success. So I probably need to stop, but so I have a few more case studies, but I think I better stop because I'm way over and I think we all have a reception. So I think it's best I close. So see me afterwards if you want to hear my other two stories. I have one from South Carolina and I have one from California. So, and I have one from Phoenix, Arizona. So anyway, see me if you want to hear those stories while we're at the cocktail hour. So sorry to be so late. Sorry.